It's been a brutal week for the beloved country. We've seen COVID-19 cases surging, and the storm the president has consistently warned about is indeed breaking, particularly in Gauteng, which recorded an additional 5,181 confirmed cases of the virus in the last 24 hours. As of the 16th of July, the South African nation has a total of 324,221 confirmed COVID-19 cases. Gauteng has recorded 117,895 cases, and that translates to just under 37% of the total cases in the country. We also saw, as of yesterday, 216 new COVID-19 related deaths recorded, taking the death toll to just under 5,000. And we've seen the collapsing Eastern Cape health system thrust into the international media spotlight. That's after weeks of coverage in local press and the release of a groundbreaking study into the effects of the lockdown on livelihoods, revealing that some 3 million South Africans have lost their jobs. With that, we go again into the front lines of this pandemic with Professor Adrian Puren, head of the Center for HIV and STIs at the National Institute of Communicable Diseases, a position he's held since 2017. He was also a member of the Lancet Commission report into the state of public health care, which was released in 2017. Professor, great to chat to you again. When one looks at the hard numbers in South Africa, would you say this indicates a failure, or is this what the models were predicting regardless of some of our interventions?
I think some of the models certainly predicted some of this, I think. I know that the models weren't necessarily there to generate an accurate number, but really just to give us a range of possibilities. And in fact, as you know, with the lockdown and the raising the line, in other words, it was really about preparedness. I think that was the key part about these particular models. It wasn't really to say, at date X, you will have that number of cases. I think we were certainly on that trajectory in the main. It would be interesting to see over the next few weeks when the revised models come up, but I think that's what we are currently seeing around our preparedness. Are we really ready for this epidemic? Yes.
And it's important to understand exactly what models are there for. I don't think we needed the models to tell us that we were in a very dire situation. Now, you joined the then National Institute for Virology way back in 1999. It was the era of the dot-com bubble, and you were part of South Africa's AIDS vaccine initiative. And I'd just like to find out from you personally what your journey has been into this career. Was it a lifelong dream fulfilled to be working in epidemiology and virology for you? How did you become the head of the NICD Center for HIV and STIs?
I'm not sure about getting to the head trip, but certainly in terms of the trajectory, yes, this is where I'd like to have been. I think it's really a passion to look not only, I started off in the immunology field and looking at what we call the cytokines. We spoke about the cytokine storm, so I've certainly worked with interleukin-1 and then later on interleukin-18. But on my return to South Africa, the opportunities arose here at then what's called the National Institute for Virology to really look at different way of health and public health specifically. So that was be my trajectory, is to look at how we can provide public health diagnostics and really to integrate that into terms of the various surveillance activities that we've certainly implemented here at NICD and with the national and provincial development. And that's been my trajectory, yes.
As part of that, you've been involved in areas of public health strengthening, and specifically in the implementation of a national quality assurance program to improve the quality of HIV testing, the gateway to care and treatment. And as I said earlier, you were part of the Lancet Commission on High Quality Healthcare. What did that report find at a time now when there are huge spotlights on the state of public healthcare in the country?
Yeah, so I think, you know, when I started off the HIV Quality Assurance Program, it was really one of the big challenges because, as you know, as you said, that's the gateway. We have 7.9 million people infected and 5 million on treatment currently. But it's really critical that, you know, people, when they enter care, know their status and the fact that you have accurate knowledge of that particular status. And that's one of the big challenges that we did have to try and implement that particular program. But I think it highlighted what I think the Lancet Commission really highlights is, again, is that some of the fragilities around our particular systems. And you've seen that when we looked at the global index around preparedness as well. I think it certainly highlighted the key fact that our health systems were not always fully prepared to face up to what we are currently facing up to. And that is, and it's at various different levels. So the WHO now prescribes a patient or person-centered care, but all around it is around governance, for example, ensuring access, making sure that there are human rights, and all these particular points that you raise. And we've seen that this week around the Eastern Cape and Lizard specifically, really highlights those particular challenges that still remain. I think there have been improvements. I think there are excellent policies around what we need to do. It's really around how do we achieve those specific objectives in order to give meaning to the policies that we have.
And I was going to say, it would seem to me that the Eastern Cape example bears testimony to the fact that many of the report's findings haven't been fully implemented yet. Where would you say the key gaps are?
I think the key gaps is really around the structure and governance around that. I think it's one of the, because I think leadership is important. I think without that leadership, not necessarily just top, but also bottom up, in other words, in order that there's a coherent vision of what this health system should be doing, I think that to me it will be really at the critical stepping point around that. I think the WHO, for example, when we talked very often, or still will talk, I'm sure, around communications. I think a communication strategy with the provinces, I think, is really key, and with the broader community. And those are the sort of things that I think are the gaps that need to be filled around ensuring that we have that vision and how we can achieve it, I think.
Now, you were subsequently appointed as Deputy Director of the National Institute for Communicable Diseases, and specifically to oversee the virology discipline. What has this entailed in particular, and how have you applied this now to COVID-19 and the current pandemic?
Well, my role has changed post that, but certainly when I started off, one of the areas around the centre's remit, or the institution's remit, is really around providing surveillance activities and ensuring that surveillance activities are carried out appropriately. And as you know, we do have an extensive vaccine or epidemiological program around vaccine. So that's the areas that I really tried to focus on to ensure that we were able to respond to. So one of the outbreaks that I was involved in was, for example, the measles outbreak in the late 90s, for example. And that gave us, again, an opportunity to see what are the deficiencies or the gaps, in other words. With measles, we really need a high level of herd immunity, and we've spoken often about that. And why is it that we had these outbreaks? And it comes back to, again, you know, around the ability to carry out, because, again, we identify hotspots. When we look at polio, for example, polio surveillance, again, there are areas where there's not sufficient surveillance being conducted, and that can lead to the vulnerabilities. So I think that's been one of the key activities that I've overseen or looked at in general over the last few years.
And now in your current role as head of the Institute for STIs and HIV, we certainly know that when we entered this pandemic, the big fear was that we had such a large, seemingly at-risk population with HIV and TB numbers that are amongst the highest anywhere in the world. How have we seen that play out as the pandemic has evolved? Because it doesn't seem that the numbers at this stage seem to point to any particular risk within that community.
Yes, so it looks as if, you know, the chances or the likelihood of becoming infected is regardless of your HIV status, and that looks quite pretty clear. And it looks as if the outcomes or risks for mortality, which I think is what we were really concerned about, is people with HIV ending up in our high care settings and ICUs being overwhelmed as a result of that. Because I think we certainly see that with flu, even though you may be virally suppressed, in fact, your outcomes may still be poorer. It looks as if that risk is far lower compared to, I think, what has been seen worldwide, and that is when we look at hypertension, diabetes, cardiac disease, and age, and the combination of age and comorbidities, I think, are still the key high-risk factors compared to HIV and possibly TB as well. So I think that provides some relief, but it doesn't mean we know that there's been a downside to this lockdown and in terms of access to care, access to testing, collection of medication and so forth. So there has certainly been a downside to what we've seen in this particular pandemic with regard to health utilization.
Absolutely, that is one of the unintended consequences. Now, turning to vaccines, it looks like one of your picks, the University of Oxford candidate, which is led by Sarah Gilbert, might be through human trials by September. AstraZeneca is lining up agreements to produce 2 billion doses. Just a remarkable achievement, considering sometimes this can take 10 to 15 years. Could this be the one?
Could be the one, but I keep on telling you that one of the titles for this week in virology is All the Spikes in One Basket. It's risky. But I think even Professor Marty agrees that there is high risk to these activities. I think the Oxford group certainly had certain advantages in the sense that they were already working on SARS and MERS vaccines. So I think that certainly put them in a good position. But again, you need to be cautious around who's this vaccine intended for, and given some of the questions around the durability of the vaccine, again, will it last? We've just seen recent publications showing that immunity can last up to 3 months. Will the vaccine achieve something similar? Or will there also be T-cell responses that will be really critical? And just an added point, as well as that, you know, we think we are in the midst of a raging epidemic, but it's quite interesting, and one of the key things is asymptomatic spread, and Professor Marty has just noted that, in fact, when they are enrolling candidates or participants into the vaccine trial, they're finding quite a few people have actually been exposed. So that's a very interesting finding.
That is interesting indeed. But it also is about the right place at the right time, because, as we know, you do need the virus to be surging, unfortunately, in the community to be running trials, and that's probably why it was good for us to be getting in there at the time that we did. Now, there's also a lot of politics at play, and on my radio show last night, you referenced Russia. If this FT article is to be believed, the race for a vaccine is getting really nasty, because we've seen state-backed Russian hackers apparently targeting pharmaceutical companies and academic institutions developing a vaccine. Have you been at the receiving end of any Russian attempts or hacks at the moment, Prof?
I've not seen a cozy bear. Sorry.
But it does show you the vast interest and geopolitical interest in developing a vaccine at this time as well. Now, over the last few weeks, we've seen a substantial amount of new evidence become available about immunity to SARS-CoV-2. Just tell me currently what we actually understand about immunity and developing herd immunity, and how long we remain immune after contracting COVID-19.
So this vaccine is really fascinating, I think, because we've never seen this before. And I think very often we try to think, well, is it behaving like MERS or CoV-1, or is it behaving like the other, you know, less virulent forms that are causing the common cold? And in fact, from the evidence, at least in terms of the vaccine, in terms of the immunity responses, it looks as if it's more like the responses are more like the common cold type. In other words, the duration may well be for a few months, in which case you can then be re-exposed and reinfected. Again, people are already commenting about that, because reinfection doesn't mean that you may have a milder disease, that you could have a worse-off disease. So I think there are these, I believe, it's very strange, there are these COVID parties where people get exposed. So there are these risks that you need to be cautious about. I think we know that a fair amount of people will have an antibody response, but that antibody response really depends on the severity of disease. And so again, when we're thinking about serological testing and vaccine development, I think we need to be cautious about what's actually going to be happening.
Prof, as we're running out of time, so far we're still learning a lot about this particular virus. What is the biggest lesson that we've learned so far that we need to really start implementing in the way we look to prevent the spread of COVID-19?
So I think one of our talks was about an exit strategy. And I don't think we have a clear one, but I think there are still some key things. So it's the long wave goodbye. I think, you know, I think when we think of flu, we thought, oh, this virus is going to be like flu. We're going to have this big peak, and then we're done. And maybe it will come back the next month. But I think...
No.
...wave for a very long time, until such time that we have treatments, vaccines. I'm afraid then those key things still remain about the physical distancing, the hand hygiene, the wearing of masks. I'm afraid those are the key messages that we're going to have to tell each other day in, day out until we see declines. And I'm afraid, again, it's complicated. We talked about testing a great deal. Our testing strategy has changed, so what information we're getting around that surveillance pattern is difficult. So we're going to have to look to death, I'm afraid, to tell us how we're currently doing.
Yeah, but unfortunately, or fortunately, one might say, that is something that is attainable rather than restructuring or fixing a healthcare system that is going to take a generation really to turn around. We can stress and impress upon people the need to wash hands and wear masks and keep their physical distance, and I think a lot more attention should be paid to that particular prevention strategy. Prof, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time on the front lines. Take care.
Thanks for the opportunity. Thank you very much.
That was Professor Adrian Puren, head of the Center for HIV and STIs at the NICD, a position that he's held since 2017. He was also a member of the Lancet Commission report into the state of public health care, talking about his experience on the front lines. Up next, the outcomes from the groundbreaking study, which used data from a mobile phone survey to produce one of the first detailed analyses of the economic effects of COVID-19 in a developing country anywhere after this.